Hello, this is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Baltimore on Q1370 WQLL. Catholic Baltimore is a weekly radio program hosted by the Archdiocese of Baltimore, airing each Sunday following the broadcast of the Radio Mass of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic radio partners for sharing with us some of the contents in this program and for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to the Archdiocese of Baltimore every Sunday.
Catholic Baltimore takes a look at the men who have led the Premier See of Baltimore since its inception in 1789. With the help of Father Michael Roach, church historian and professor of church history at Mount St. Mary Seminary, we are offered a glimpse into the challenges and achievements, the education and background, and the leadership qualities of those men who have served as Archbishop of Baltimore. This is Sean Kane, and you're listening to Catholic Baltimore. We're here with Father Michael Roach. Father Michael, thanks for being with us.
It's good to be here.
So what do we know about Francis Patrick Kenrick, who would succeed Samuel Eccleston in 1851 after a 17-year episcopacy?
A rather remarkable family, actually. There are two archbishops in that family, Francis Patrick in Baltimore and Peter Richard in St. Louis. They were Dublin-born, came to this country to serve in the missions. Francis Patrick Kenrick was on the frontier for a while in Kentucky, taught in the seminary there at Bardstown, and eventually is named as Bishop of Philadelphia, and then later as Archbishop of Baltimore. A scholarly man, and a great translator of the scriptures, something of a moral theologian. His moral theology was used for many years in Catholic seminaries in this country.
Was he the first Archbishop of Baltimore who previously had served as bishop somewhere else?
He was the first one promoted to Baltimore, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And do we have a sense of how that prior experience might have helped him in his new position?
Well, one thing he would have brought from Philadelphia was a passion for the schools, which was always emblematic of Philadelphia diocese. He also, up in Philadelphia, had made the friendship of John Nepomucene Newman, the Redemptorist bishop, the Redemptorist who becomes a bishop. In fact, I think that Newman was his spiritual director when he was Bishop of Philadelphia.
He said, as the son of a scrivener, to have had meticulous handwriting and also was fluent in four modern languages and three ancient ones. That's quite a background for a bishop.
Yeah, very much the professor, and he had taught in the seminary early on and continued to write all of his days.
What were some of the things that he wrote about? We know he was responsible for an English translation of the New Testament, and then he wrote about the real presence of the Eucharist. Were there other topics that seemed to be of interest to him?
Well, unfortunately, he writes on the question of slavery in a rather benighted fashion, and says that slavery is not immoral, but the taking of slaves is, the holding of slaves is not. And that's a very embarrassing position that sort of marred the church for many years.
And would that have been reflective of in other words, was he an outlier in thinking that way at the time, or was he just voicing what others felt privately?
Interestingly, it probably is indicative of the immigrant's unfortunate desire to be accepted and to be American, to be truly American. So you take on the values of the society you've come to and try to be more American than the Americans.
He presided over the first plenary council, and every 3 years the provincial councils and synods. What do we know? I think the prerogative of place emerged from one of these. What other decrees might have come out of these meetings?
Well, again, finances are always a great concern. Seasons of the church, uniformity in liturgy, and just many, many practical things were dealt with. When you read the decretals of these various councils, they go on and on and on. There's almost no end to them.
And what was the picture in the church at this point? This is the 1850s. Civil War is coming upon us. What was the What was the country looking like, both in the Catholic population but also secularly?
Well, this is also the great era of persecution of the church by the nativists and the know-nothings. So it was said that even in Baltimore, when traveling, the sisters wouldn't wear their habits because they were afraid they'd get hassled too much. And you read records of them going hither and yon and having to don secular clothes. There were many, many problems for the church in those days, mainly external, not internal so much.
And give us a quick history lesson on the Know-Nothings.
The Know-Nothings, the American Party. Called Know-Nothing because whenever they're questioned about, they knew nothing, you know. And they gained a lot of political sway and held some state houses in the country. In one particular election in Maryland, the Know-Nothings carried everything except Emmitsburg and Leonardtown. So they were a threat politically, but also practically. Church burnings, rioting, and the like.
It said we owe our connection to the 40 hours of devotion here in the Archdiocese to Archbishop Kenrick, perhaps something else that came out of Philadelphia.
Sure. Through St. John Newman actually was the one who brought the 40 hours of devotion and propagated it in Philadelphia. And then when Bishop Kenrick became Archbishop Kenrick here in Baltimore, he brought that with him. Interestingly enough, it's still pretty highly preserved in Pennsylvania. Many, many parishes in Pennsylvania still keep the 40 hours, which has largely disappeared here except for the ethnic parishes.
And for those who are unfamiliar with it, just briefly explain the 40 hours.
Oh, it's 40 hours of Eucharistic adoration, usually over a weekend marked by devotions and sermons.
Do we have a good understanding of how Archbishop Kenrick handled the outset of the Civil War and maybe how that might have impacted his episcopacy at all?
Right. Sadly, he dies the same week as the Battle of Gettysburg. So Maryland, which was so terribly divided during the Civil War, it find itself even thrown into more chaos by the death of the archbishop at that decisive battle. He was not particularly partisan, although I have to say, we need to remember that the Catholic paper at that time was privately owned, and so they didn't take their marching orders from the archbishop. And so at one point, the Catholic Mirror is so partisanly Confederate that the two editors are arrested and put in jail, as a matter of fact, for sedition.
It's history suggests that he had a rather lengthy competition, shall we say, with Archbishop Hughes from his days in Philadelphia. What do we know about that?
Hughes was a great man, but he was also a wild man, and he wasn't anyone to be toyed with. And I think there may have been a certain pettiness about Archbishop Kenrick, and he tried to nail John Hughes a few times, which was not something you could pull off too well. John Hughes had a lot of connections in Baltimore, though he was from Ireland and then to Chambersburg, PA, but he had a lot of family and kin here in Baltimore, so he was often here for various events, and Kenrick could be a bit carping about him.
And was Archbishop Hughes serving in, where was he serving at the time, or would have been serving while Archbishop Kenrick was in Baltimore?
A bishop of New York.
In New York, right. What was Archbishop Kenrick's relationship like with the priests? Do we have an indication of that?
I don't think he was a great favorite. I'm not sure. But mm-hmm. Baltimore priests have always been terribly independent, so that's not a surprise.
The diocese certainly grew exponentially in his time, given the influx of immigrants. Would you look at his record and suggest that Francis Patrick Kenrick was up to the challenge?
He certainly was, particularly in the earliest years of his reign. A very bright man, there's no question about it. But how energetic he was, particularly toward the end, I wouldn't be willing to say.
So not the vitality that Samuel Eccleston had for sure.
No, 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 no.
Any final words on Francis Patrick Kenrick?
It's a shame that his teaching on interracial relations was so backward, because he really was a fine scholar in other ways, but he did have this blind spot.
That's Father Michael Roach speaking about the episcopacy of Archbishop Francis Patrick Kenrick in the Archdiocese of Baltimore.
Catholic news from the Archdiocese of Baltimore and around the world from the Catholic Review. The founder of the Knights of Columbus changed and transformed countless lives. Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore praised the Knights' founder, Father Michael McGivney, for the charity and unity the Knights display. In a homily at the annual Knights Convention in Philadelphia, August 6th, the Archbishop said Father McGivney drew these values from the heart of the gospel. The Knights of Columbus is a fraternal organization with more than 27,000 members in Maryland who contribute thousands of volunteer hours and an equally impressive amount of charitable aid each year. About 20 Marylanders will undertake a 100-mile walk in honor of the upcoming visit of Pope Francis to the USA. The walkers will start September 20th from the Basilica of the Assumption in downtown Baltimore and spend 7 days walking to Philadelphia, where they will join hundreds of thousands of others at the Festival of Families, September 26th, and a mass celebrated by the Pope the next day. A service project will accompany the walking pilgrimage to collect new and gently used shoes. The shoes will be taken by a social enterprise to developing countries such as Haiti and many countries in Africa. There, the shoes are distributed to local people to start a microbusiness, repairing and selling the shoes. These people earn money by providing a need, and your contribution of shoes keeps them out of the landfill. It's a great way to respond to Pope Francis's call to protect the environment and help those who need a hand up, not a hand out. Read more on the web at catholicreview.org or in this week's Catholic Review newspaper. In other papal visit news, time is running out to join the Archdiocesan bus pilgrimage to the Pope's Mass in Philadelphia. Information on the bus trip is available on the web at francisinphilly.org. Ticket sales for the pilgrimage close this week on August 21st. From the newsroom of the Catholic Review, this is Christopher Gunty.
Do you want to know more about what's going on in the church and the world than you can get from your daily newspaper or local TV? Read the only newspaper in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the church full-time, the Catholic Review. The print newspaper can be delivered to your home every other Thursday, and you can get fresh news every day online at catholicreview.org. Subscribe to the Catholic Review e-newsletter for twice-a-week updates. Find our app on Apple and Android, and follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Wherever your faith takes you, Catholic Review Media is ready to inspire, teach, inform, and engage. Read it today, in print and online at catholicreview.org. Again, online, that's catholicreview.org.
Life can be hard, and at times we feel overwhelmed and alone. When faced with problems, know that there is a group of Catholics who are part of the prayer ministry of the Archdiocese of Baltimore, waiting to lift you and your needs to God in prayer. This ministry is comprised of men and women, young and old, religious and lay, from every ethnic and cultural background. They pray as individuals and in groups, in homes and meeting spaces throughout Baltimore. Like you, they are people who have suffered the same hurts, fears, pains, sickness, loss, and everyday burdens. Learn more about this ministry by visiting our website at www.archbalt.org. If you are in need of prayer, send your prayer request to prayers@archbalt.org or by phone to 410-547-5517. Would you like to volunteer to be a part of the ministry? Prayer ministers are always needed. Please call or email our coordinator, who would be happy to speak with you.
Catholic Baltimore takes a look at the men who have led the Premier See of Baltimore since its inception in 1789. With the help of Father Michael Roach, church historian and professor of church history at Mount St. Mary Seminary, we are offered a glimpse into the challenges and achievements, the education and background, and the leadership qualities of those men who have served as Archbishop of Baltimore. This is Sean Kane, and you're listening to Catholic Baltimore. We're here today with Father Michael Roach. Father Michael, thanks for being with us today.
Terrific to be here.
So, the 7th Archbishop of Baltimore, Martin Spaulding, certainly a last name well known to Baltimoreans and to Baltimore Catholics because of the high school in Severn. But I suspect we might remember him for reasons beyond that.
Indeed, indeed. Well, his family was a great family. We have his nephew, John Lancaster Spaulding, one of the giants of the 19th century church, his cousin, Mother Catherine Spaulding, who founds the first congregation of religious women west of the Alleghenies. So it's a marvelous, marvelous family, and there's still some Spaulding relatives here in Baltimore.
And he's not from Maryland, but his parents were born here. Is that correct?
Indeed, indeed. Many of the families of Southern Maryland emigrated out to Kentucky. There was something of a agricultural depression in Southern Maryland because tobacco wears out the nitrates in the fields, and so they moved on. Many moved out into Kentucky.
Of his educational upbringing, is it true that he defended 365 theses to earn his doctorate degree in divinity at the Urban College in Rome?
I think so. I think he was one of the first people from America to go to the Urban College, and he really set a great record there for those who would follow him.
He also had a good deal of pastoral and administrative experience before becoming a bishop, didn't he?
Absolutely. I think he was 14 when he went to the Urban College, which is pretty remarkable right there.
Absolutely. So he'd been a pastor of three different churches in Kentucky and then president of St. Joseph's in Kentucky?
Right, absolutely.
And like Kenrick, he was fond of writing and was considered a bit of a scholar.
Indeed he was. That whole Kentucky phenomenon is interesting. They call that the American Holy Land. So much was going on out there.
And he's said to have identified with the needs of the 19th century immigrant perhaps more than any other Archbishop of Baltimore. Why is that?
Right. Well, I think he saw the situation in it's hard to assess the terrible damage that any war does, most especially a civil war. So Baltimore, after the Civil War, was desolate, and he addressed those needs by bringing the Sisters of the Good Shepherd up from Louisville to form protectories, and the Zavarian Brothers to start the fabled St. Mary's Industrial School. Mm. He was very keen on addressing the problems that were so apparent in post-Civil War Baltimore. Mm.
And did what were his thoughts on again immigration would continue to be an issue that especially for the church that they would have to deal with the integration of the new with the old, if you will. Mm-hmm. What was his approach to that ministry?
Well, much like the old American families, he was very keen on serving the immigrant. That ironic situation that it was often the old Americans that were more adept in working with the immigrant populations. He had a great social consciousness, something wasn't spoken about in those days too much. So he was on to address this question, that problem, this challenge. Also, it is his days that the original Josephites came to America, the Society of the Sacred Heart. St. Joseph's Society of the Sacred Heart, who become the Josephites. So he's keen, again, on the black apostolate. There had been an unfortunate dropping of the ball when it came to addressing the evangelization of the freed slaves. And he and a few others, his cousin Archbishop Elder, would be another one who was keen on addressing and evangelizing the new population of freedmen.
He was known as the Lion of Baltimore. Do we know how he came about that nickname?
He took nothing off nobody. yes, he was a stellar figure. Not particularly popular with the priests of the diocese, but quite a stellar figure nationally.
And what do you think was the cause of that maybe lack of popularity?
Was it just he was a strong figure.
His leadership
right,
style.
Right. He was quite a contrast to people like Gibbons who let things go. Mm.
He was also considered a skilled administrator and said to possess legislative skills beyond the ordinary. How do you think that he benefited from these strengths in his position as Archbishop of Baltimore?
I think he was listened to on a national level. He was still regarded as the leader of the American hierarchy. You could see that at the First Vatican Council, where he was turned to quite often.
He's said to have been in a pretty significant spat with the Sulpicians over financial support for St. Mary's Seminary. Mm-hmm. Reportedly, the rector, I guess the custom at the time was that the diocese held collections, annual collections,
right,
and other dioceses paid tuition for their students, and this archbishop wasn't having that.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know how that manifested itself? Or,
well, he was a very smart administrator, a very smart finance man. He's the one who began the Cathedraticum, the cathedral tax, and it was geared to the wealthier parishes paid a greater amount, the poorer parishes paid a lesser amount. It was scaled. So it's easy to see where he wouldn't want to give anyone a free ride if he was being so cautious about the finances of the diocese. The Sulpicians did very often enjoy a privileged status in the diocese, and he wasn't having any of that.
The Second Plenary Council occurred under his watch, and yielded some pretty important decrees: a uniform catechism, the establishment of a Catholic university, aid to Black Catholics. How much of this has Martin Spalding's hand in it, would you think?
Right. He was certainly disappointed on the lack of aid to the Black Catholics. There had been a proposal at the Second Plenary Council that there be a separate vicariate set up just to serve the African-American population in the United States. And there was terrible resistance to it because some of the archbishops, like Peter Richard Kenrick, were afraid it would eat away at their prerogatives and at their independence. But there were beautiful sermons given by Spalding and his cousin, Archbishop Elder, a wonderful phrase: by the very bowels of God, we pray to you to address the fortunes of these 4 million now freed slaves.
He's said to have kind of deftly displayed a healthy sense of nativism, as well as a nice balance in terms of his loyalty to Rome. What do we know of that?
Right. Balance is a very good choice of words, because at the First Vatican Council, he is clearly in favor of infallibility. He doesn't quite think this is the time to do it. So he's in the camp that is often called inopportunist. So he often did the balancing act that is required in dealing between Gallicanism and Ultramontanism. Between an over-loyalty, if you will, to Rome, and an over-independence of the local church.
Probably a reflection of the balance that must have been felt in terms of the influx of immigrants at the time, and yet a still fairly young nation that's still trying to get its legs under it as it expands.
Mm-hmm. When pastors disagreed with him, they'd often write letters under anonymous names to the Catholic Mirror, which was more than delighted to publish them, and I think that rankled the Archbishop a bit.
He's said to have battled pretty significant illnesses several times throughout his life, and certainly his episcopacy. One that would eventually lead to what many consider his premature death, and many speculated that he might have been the first American cardinal had he lived.
That's an interesting question. I will say this: his photographs and his pictures, he doesn't look good in any of them. He always looks like he's not that far from death. Mm-hmm. The question of his getting a cardinalature, that was mentioned, but there are those who said he wasn't quite emphatic enough in his leadership at the First Vatican Council in getting that infallibility ratified, and because his support was a little anemic, that's why he never became a cardinal, the first American cardinal.
So the final words on Archbishop Martin Spalding.
Certainly one of the great archbishops of Baltimore. In the Premier See, his great-great-great-nephew, Brother Tom Spalding, makes him very close to the best Archbishop of Baltimore, but I think that's a bit of a family prejudice. But he still was a great archbishop.
There you have it from Father Michael Roach, the episcopacy of the 7th Archbishop of Baltimore, Martin Spalding.
You are listening to Catholic Baltimore on Q1370 WQLL.
Are you interested in joining the Archdiocese of Baltimore and Catholic Review Media on a bus pilgrimage to the Papal Mass in Philadelphia, September 27th? Pope Francis is expected to celebrate an outdoor mass along Philadelphia's famed Benjamin Franklin Parkway. It will be a huge crowd and a great way to celebrate our faith together with hundreds of thousands of fellow Catholics, even if the Pope is just a tiny dot from your vantage point, or you can only see him on a video screen. You will want to join what will probably be the largest gathering of Catholics in the USA this year. For more information about the September 27th pilgrimage to the Papal Mass, visit tinyurl.com/CR-Philly Bus. That's tinyurl.com/CR-Philly Bus or call 443-524-3150. 443-524-3150. See you in Philly.
For 143 years, New Cathedral Cemetery has served the needs of the Catholic community of Baltimore and Central Maryland. New Cathedral is the only cemetery owned by the Archdiocese of Baltimore and is the final resting place for many religious orders and famous citizens. 125 acres of rolling hills, trees, and beautiful monuments, the cemetery is an oasis of peace and tranquility and is located off Edmondson Avenue just outside of Catonsville. New Cathedral is dedicated to the task of tending to the mortal remains of our dearly departed and has many more years of available space. If you are in need of a burial site, vault, monument, or marker, or just a respectful location to place your cremated loved ones, our counselors will help you through this process and make sure the wishes of you and your loved ones are honored. Visit us online at newcathedralcemetery.org, like us on Facebook at New Cathedral Cemetery Bonnie Bray, or call 410-566-7770.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Baltimore. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May God bless us and keep us always in his love.